Ladies and gentlemen, your conference call is about to begin. Here is your moderator, Adam Pechter.
Thank you, operator. Today we're lucky to have Patrick Clawson, a leading specialist on Iran at the Washington Institute, and also a member of the Middle East Forum's Board of Governors, to discuss the upcoming Iranian elections and their implications for U.S.-Iranian relations. Dr. Clawson is the author or editor of 25 books and monographs, including The Last Resort, Consequences of Preventive Military Action Against Iran. He appears frequently on television and radio and has published op-ed articles in major newspapers like the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post. He speaks Persian and holds a doctorate in economics. So without further ado, Patrick, please take it away.
Great. Let me jump right into the topic about Iran's presidential elections. Of course, I'd be happy to talk about the threats represented by Iran's nuclear program or its support for terrorism or its interference in countries in the region, but let me talk about the presidential elections, which are a week from tomorrow. And Iran's president is not really that powerful a figure in the country's system. He has some say over economic and social policies, but the areas of foreign and security policy in particular are very much the domain of the leader, or as he likes to call himself, the supreme leader, that is to say, the chief cleric, who has the authority to dismiss the president and to overrule any laws. That, for the last 20 years, has been a man named Ali Khamenei, and Khamenei has slowly over time become more and more powerful until now he is firmly in control of security and foreign policy. And indeed, I like to describe the president as the cheerleader-in-chief rather than the commander-in-chief, because it is the supreme leader who appoints the heads of the military and of the intelligence service and many of the revolutionary bodies that hold real power. On top of that, these elections are... Well, that's a polite word. The president of Iran is selected more than he's elected because there's only a few people allowed to run. The candidates are tightly vetted by a body appointed by Khamenei, and only those loyal to the system are allowed through. And then the election itself is badly rigged, including the actual vote counting, where there's typically massive fraud. So do we care about this presidential election at all? Well, actually, yes, we do, because, in fact, the presidential campaign is a time which is used by the Iranian supreme leader to gauge what is the popular opinion and the opinion of the educated elite, and to adjust his policies as required. And there have been several times when the supreme leader has had to allow a president to be elected who he didn't particularly like, but he realized that he had to make some compromises in order to stay in power. And this system in Iran is really quite good at being flexible, and that's one reason it's lasted so long. So in this election, we can tell that Khamenei is very comfortable with the incumbent president, Ahmadinejad. This is a kind of guy whom he works very well and whose worldview he endorses. But if Khamenei finds that, in fact, Ahmadinejad is really stirred up a lot of opposition at home, and if Khamenei becomes persuaded that some compromise with the West is going to be required, he may well allow somebody else to be elected instead of Ahmadinejad. I would have said 3 or 4 weeks ago that Ahmadinejad's re-election was a slam dunk because Ahmadinejad so strongly enjoys the support of the supreme leader, and also because Ahmadinejad has been able to hand out huge amounts of money with this oil windfall that Iran's had during the last 4 years as he's been president. And Ahmadinejad has been clever about handing that money out to his political base, which is people in the rural areas and in the small towns who have gotten quite a lot of cash from the central government, and therefore in many cases are big fans of Ahmadinejad. However, in the election, in the last couple of weeks, other candidates are actually been doing quite well in campaigning against Ahmadinejad. There was a debate last night between the principal, he's a principal opponent, who is a former prime minister from 20 years ago before they abolished the job of prime minister. And that gentleman concentrated his attacks on Ahmadinejad's foreign policy, saying that Ahmadinejad has needlessly caused enemies and needlessly besmirched the name of Iran by his wild statements. So if that gentleman, whose name is Mousavi, gets elected, we could probably expect a rather different foreign policy. Would it be one that we like? No. It would be a foreign policy that would be one, I like to describe Mousavi's foreign policy approach as being one of blowing smoke in our eyes, whereas Ahmadinejad's policy was one of spitting in our eyes. And there are some real disadvantages of having somebody like Mousavi who smiles at you, but meanwhile continues with his dangerous activities. But that would be the challenge for U.S. diplomacy if Mousavi wins, is figuring out a way to corner him so that he has to make more substantive compromises. So let me stop there and see if there's any questions.
Okay, for everyone to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I will announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember that if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. Again, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, our first caller is Ms. Nina Rosenwald. Go ahead, Ms.
Oh, hi, Patrick. Nina Rosenwald. I was wondering, in the light of Obama saying, gee, he's going to sort of wait until January to reassess if there should be military action by anybody or his options open, if that's just sort of flabbiness and what one can do to try and firm up the military action option, should it be necessary?
The most important precondition for a successful military action is that there is broad international acceptance of the need for that military action. Why do I say that? I say that because the military action at its most successful would destroy what Iran now has. And if Iran is determined to rebuild, then it could reconstitute its program in the space of a few years. Some say 2 years, I think probably more like 4 years. But a real success of a military strike would come if that military strike persuades the Iranians that the pursuit of their nuclear program is fruitless, that they'll never be allowed to enjoy the benefits of a weapons program, and that therefore they would be better advised just to stop the program. And in order for that to happen, the military action should will be more effective if it is received by at least an international acceptance. I'm not going to say an international support, but an attitude that says that, look, it's the Iranians' fault that they brought this on themselves. And if we can form a broad international consensus that the Iranians are the ones who are blocking progress and who are being unreasonable, and that, in fact, we in the West have gone an extra mile to try to reach a compromise, but the Iranians have refused any of our reasonable offers, that, I think, would do much to impress people around the world, including people in Iran, that it's the Iranian government which is provoking a crisis here. And one of the big problems the United States faced in recent years is that many around the world blame the U.S. for being obstinate and unreasonable rather than blaming the Iranians. I don't think that was particularly fair, but the fact is that that's what happened. And now with Obama's very open enthusiasm for engagement with the Iranians, really the shoe's on the other foot, and the attitude is growing that it's the Iranians who are missing an opportunity. After the presidential election, we'll have to see what the new president does. Even if Ahmadinejad is reelected, perhaps he'll change his tune. I don't think he'd do that unless he felt that Iran really were weak and in some danger, and at least so far I don't see any signs of that. But in any case, it should become clear by fall whether or not Iran's interested in engaging. And if Iran is clever and does engage, then it will become clear within a few months after that, let's say by the 1st of January, whether in fact Iran is just stalling or whether in fact Iran is substantively willing to make progress.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Mr. William Seltzer. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay. I just feel, I suppose I'm prejudiced, but what you're saying, it seems that I've been hearing for years from various sources, and that diplomacy has really diluted 1 inch of the Iranian foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel, for sure. And I don't see anything happening except that Iran's bomb will get closer to being ripe and consequently more difficult options to implode. I just don't know where we're going with this unless somebody drops a bomb.
Well, the chances of success of diplomacy are not good, and I would say that they're less than 1 in 3, and I'm quite an optimist. But there is some prospect that that diplomacy might succeed. I mean, at root, Iran is a weak country and a poor country. It's been feeling strong. It's been punching above its weight because the United States has been bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan and because the price of oil was so high for a while. But in reality, the Iranian regime has got feet of clay. It's not popular at home, and the country's economy is, in fact, a house of cards, all dependent upon a high price of oil. So there is some possibility that the Iranians will recognize a need to compromise. This, after all, is this revolutionary regime in Iran has done difficult compromises in the past. They fought an 8-year war with Iraq in which several hundred thousand Iranians died, and the revolutionary Iran made that war the absolute centerpiece of their revolution. But in the end, they agreed to a ceasefire in which Iran gained exactly nothing because they felt they had to, and the country was weak, and the continued existence of the Islamic Republic was at risk. So there is some prospect that we can get to a diplomatic compromise, but as you say, it's not a good one. However, the use of military force is not something that we want to do lightly, and we are more likely to have success in using military force if that comes at a time when Iranians themselves feel that their government has been the source of the problem, as being obstinate and unhelpful, because then our military force will be working with the Iranian people's sentiments rather than a military force that inflames nationalist passions inside Iran and makes ordinary Iranians determined to pursue the nuclear program all the more vigorously. Even though the prospects for diplomacy have not been good, the time has not been ripe to use military force yet. That may change in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Mr. David Kudish. Go ahead.
Thank you. One of the many confusing aspects of all of this is to see China and, to a much greater extent, Russia supporting the Iranian regime when there's such an antithesis between what the Soviets did not that many years ago in Afghanistan and in the southern regions of the other stands to Muslims. What is the end game for the Soviets to block U.S. efforts in the UN? What's their rationale?
Well, for the Chinese, the answer is pretty simple. They just don't care. They just don't see the Iranian nuclear program or an Iranian nuclear bomb as a matter that should concern them particularly. And they don't want to let the Iranian nuclear issue get in the way of what's a very lucrative market for them, because they are rapidly becoming Iran's largest supplier. For the Russians, the answer is more complicated. Partly it's that the Russians are convinced that the Iranians are incompetent and that, in fact, that their program is going slower than we think it is, and that Iranian claimed successes are exaggerated. And I have to admit that there's been several times in the last 8 years when, indeed, the Russians were more correct than Western intelligence agencies about Iranian nuclear progress, that progress had, in fact, been more limited than we had at first thought. But also another important factor in the Russian thinking is that the Russians are convinced that if the Iranian nuclear program ever becomes a serious problem, that in the end of the day, America or Israel or both will take care of it, and that therefore there's no particular reason for Russia to pay any price in its relationships with Iran for trying to stop the program. The Russians' attitude is, look, at the end of the day, the Americans and the Israelis will do it, and so don't worry about it. Furthermore, another very important element is that the Russians see no particular reason to be helpful to the West, particularly the United States. Indeed, they see lots of reasons to be unhelpful. Great concern of the Russian government is to repeal the 1990s and to get back to the situation where Russia had a sphere of influence in all of the countries that made up the former Soviet Union. And they put that priority above all others. And so they're just not prepared to put that much effort into stopping the Iranian nuclear program. Indeed, from the Russian point of view, it's not so bad if they can use the Iranian nuclear program as a way to preoccupy the United States and to force the United States to make compromises about issues like Georgia in the hopes of securing Russian cooperation on the Iranian nuclear program.
Okay, that's the end of our questions. If anybody else has a question, you can just press star one.
Sure.
Adam, I'll turn it back to you.
Sure. Thank you very much. Patrick, I have a question for you. From today's speech, from the president's speech today, did you hear anything in the speech that you think could and should impact the Iranian elections upcoming?
I hope not, and I don't see anything at first glance. I mean, when you get right down to it, this was really a speech directed at the Arab world much more than a speech directed at the Muslim world. I wish it had been billed that way, because I don't think it's a good idea for us to talk about a Muslim world. From a political point of view, there is no Muslim world any more than there is a Christian world, and I don't think it's useful to think about the conflicts that the United States has had with some of the governments in the areas being religious conflicts, just as I think it's a terrible idea to think about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as being a religious conflict rather than a nationalist one. So, indeed, the president's speech was overwhelmingly about Arab politics and Arab issues, and he really made only a few passing references to Iran, and that one point about of his seven about the Iranian nuclear program, which is really quite not a path breaking, but instead a repetition of existing U.S. stances.
Adam?
Operator, any more questions, or that's it?
No, that's it for questions.
That's it. Okay.
Well, can I make a comment about Israel and the United States? Let me just point out to people that that it's hardly surprising that Israel regards this Iran issue as much more of a threat than the United States does, because Israel is much more the object of Iran's ire, and Israel is so much of a smaller country that even one or two bombs from Iran could effectively end Israel's existence as an independent country. In this situation, there's grave potential that that the United States and Israel will not see things eye to eye, and that Israel will come to the conclusion that the United States is not prepared to take the kind of bold action needed to stop Iran's program that Israel thinks is necessary. So if I had to offer a bet, I would say that the chances of this Iran nuclear issue leading to an Israeli military strike against Iran and a U.S. Contretemps, if not confrontation with Israel over the matter, the chances of that happening are unfortunately higher than the chances of a diplomatic resolution of this of the Iranian nuclear issue. So that's very discouraging, and I'm certainly working my best to try to reduce the chance of that happening, but I have to say that that's where we stand at the moment.
Do you see the Mousavi debate that was broadcast on national television as sort of a deliberate attempt by the regime to sort of appease international critics? I mean, or did that just sort of get out of the box before they could control it kind of thing?
Well, Mousavi and Ahmadinejad do not like each other personally and represent very different political camps. And a real brawl between the two of them, as we saw in last night's debate, is very useful for the Islamic Republic in trying to present the presidential election as a real choice, whereas in fact the two candidates are both very committed to the Islamic Republic and very similar in viewpoints in many ways. For instance, Mr. Mousavi, who's widely described as the reform candidate, he happens to be the first cousin of the Supreme Leader. They've been close to each other ever since they were little kids. And so the idea that Mousavi is going to implement some big change in the policies that were introduced by the Supreme Leader just strikes me as, implausible.
And the Holocaust rhetoric, where he chided Ahmadinejad about his, you know, taking that the position on the Holocaust, is that sort of empty rhetoric in your mind in regard to the Supreme Leader's stance on the issue?
Well, the Supreme Leader is someone who has for many years greeted visiting Holocaust deniers, invited them to Iran, and has made clear that he does not think that there was such a thing as a Holocaust. That's the kind of position which Mousavi thinks is ridiculous, because Mousavi's attitude is, what is Iran doing sticking its nose into these matters? That's not our concern. We shouldn't be doing that. Don't think, however, that therefore Mousavi is somehow a friend of Israel or prepared to live with Israel. No, quite the contrary. He instead presents himself as somebody who's more solidly based in fact than Ahmadinejad, but he does not present himself as someone with a different political agenda than Ahmadinejad.
Thank you. Operator, any more questions?
No more questions.
Patrick, would you mind giving out your email address in case somebody thinks of something tonight or wants to contact you about the issue in the days and weeks ahead?
Certainly. I can be reached at the Washington Institute at my email, which is based on my name. It's the letter P and then my last name, P. Clausen. So that's all spelled as one word, P. Clausen, at Washington Institute, which is one great big long word, washingtoninstitute.org.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.